2 Peter 2, verses 13 through 16, the ninth talk in a series on the book of 2 Peter, was presented by Ron Julian on August 19, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We are continuing in our series in 2 Peter. We're in chapter 2. And chapter 2 is that part of 2 Peter where he issues very stern warnings to his readers against those that he calls the false teachers. He denounces these false teachers using very strong language, very strong language. He waxes poetic on how bad they are. In the past several weeks, we've seen Peter making some difficult points referring to angels and seemingly quoting some books that are not in the Bible and raising a number of questions on exactly what he was doing with those books and what he was saying. His general warning against the false teachers was clear enough, but his specific points have been tough to sort out. Today, we're going to see Peter making a point that depends on something in the Bible from the Old Testament, and this time I think that the point that he's making is going to be quite clear. And I think that this passage is actually going to be helpful for us to see what Peter's major concern is in writing this letter. So let me read you the passage we're going to look at today. This is in 2 Peter chapter 2, starting in verse 13. Suffering wrong as the wages of doing wrong, they count it a pleasure to revel in the daytime. They are stains and blemishes, reveling in their deceptions as they carouse with you, having eyes full of adultery and that never cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, having a heart trained in greed, accursed children. Forsaking the right way, they have gone astray, having followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness, but he received a rebuke for his own transgression, for a dumb donkey, speaking with a voice of a man, restrained the madness of the prophet. So Peter is referring back to the quite unusual story of Balaam from Numbers in the Old Testament. As I say, I think we're going to come away feeling fairly confident that we understand what his point is, but it actually is not immediately obvious because Balaam's story is a little bit involved and unusual, and it takes some thinking about to see what it is that's going on there. So that's what I want to do. Most of our time today is going to be spent going back and looking at Numbers to try to think about what is going on with Balaam so that we can understand the point that Peter is making when he refers back to this. This story comes from the book of Numbers, chapters 22 through 24. You probably remember the story of how God, through Moses, led Israel out of Egypt and into the Promised Land. If nothing else, you've probably seen the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston. The first time that God brought Israel to the Promised Land, you may remember, they refused to go in out of fear of the people in the land. And so God sent that generation to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. It would be the next generation that God would take into the Promised Land. The part of Numbers that we are going to look at deals presumably, I think, with the later part of Israel's wilderness journey. It tells of Israel's journey back toward the Promised Land, and as they are on their way, God blesses them with victory over whoever might attack them on the way. So the Moabites and the Midianites hear the stories about how Israel is conquering as they go. They hear the stories about how their God, Yahweh, is intervening for them, and they're having this great success. They're terrified that the Israelites are going to come in and overrun them. So it is at this point in the story that two characters with similar names come into the story. Balak is the king of Moab. Balaam is a seer, a soothsayer. So, in Numbers 22:5, we read that Balak sends messengers to this seer, Balaam. Numbers 22:5, so Balak sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river, in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, "Behold, a people came out of Egypt. Behold, they cover the surface of the land, and they are living opposite me. Now, therefore, please come, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I may be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." So Balak, the Moabite king, knows that Israel has a God who is looking out for them. From his perspective, this is an unfair advantage, so he wants to level the playing field. So he wants to bring in Balaam to curse the Israelites. And essentially, what he wants Balaam to do is to intervene to somehow cause Yahweh to stop blessing Israel. Now, the king believes that Balaam has the power to do this. He says, "Whom Balaam blesses is blessed, and whom Balaam curses is cursed." We don't know whether Balaam's reputation is well earned. We don't really have any background up to this on Balaam. We don't have any background on Balaam up to this point. Why did people think that he could do this? We do know that God at times allowed various forms of demonic supernatural activity. He did this to demonstrate his absolute power over any other force in creation. So it's possible that Balaam actually had some genuine supernatural power, some contacts that somehow made it possible for him to bless and curse in this way. Or maybe he was just good at self-promotion and had convinced everyone that he could do that. I don't really know the answer to that question. But the king of Moab is convinced that Balaam can somehow neutralize the intervention of God on Israel's behalf. Now, at this point in the story, there's a very interesting story involving Balaam and a donkey. But we're going to come back to that in a minute. I'm going to skip that for a minute. In fact, let's pretend that the story about Balaam and the donkey is not there. If the story were not there, what sort of impression would we get of Balaam from the rest of the story after this little interlude with the donkey? Well, this is what happens afterwards. Balak, the king of Moab, is anxious for Balaam to get started and to curse Israel. Balaam comes, finally, and there he is, and Balak's saying, "Okay, let's get going." Balaam, however, tells the king that he will speak only what God gives him to say. He's sort of warning him, you know, this may not turn out the way you think, because I'm going to have to say what God gives me to say. And so they go to the first time. Balaam tells him to make a big offering, and okay, Balak's saying, "Great, go for it." And Balaam pronounces a blessing on Israel, not a curse, because this is what God gives him to say. He's acting as a true prophet in this situation, speaking for God and pronouncing a blessing on Israel. Well, Balak, the king, is beside himself. "That's not what I asked you to do. What have you done to me? You blessed them, not cursed them. So let's try this again. Let's go to another vantage point where we can look out on them, and you do this cursing thing." And they do this several times, and each time Balaam ends up blessing Israel instead of cursing. Ultimately, there are four blessings that he pronounces on Israel, and Balak is furious and tells him to get lost. Okay, so if we just took that part of the story, it might seem that Balaam is a pretty good guy. I mean, the king was promising him great wealth. "Hey, we're going to pay you if you curse these guys." And yet Balaam would not pronounce this curse, but pronounced a blessing instead. Maybe he's a genuine believer in Yahweh. Maybe he's one of those non-Israelite believers like Melchizedek or something like that. Someone who actually believed and trusted in Yahweh and wouldn't, even though it was going to end up costing him, he would only pronounce a blessing. That might be a way that we could understand it, but we can't help but notice that Peter doesn't take the story that way. That's not how he understands Balaam. And other biblical writers also do not understand Balaam in this way. Whenever they make any sort of comment about Balaam himself, it is always a negative comment that they make. Where's that coming from? Well, I think there are at least two reasons why we should see and why the biblical authors see Balaam as a bad guy. The first involves this story of the donkey, the one that we just skipped. So we're going to have to go look at that and see what's going on there. And the other reason is a tiny little addition, a teeny little phrase that gets slipped into a sentence later in the book of Numbers that kind of finishes off the story of Balaam for us and tells us something very important. So we're going to want to look at both of those things. We want to look at the story about the donkey, and we want to look at this little phrase that gets inserted later in Numbers. So first, we'll take the story about the donkey. So we're backing up now. Balaam has not yet gone and done his blessings. What's happened is Balak, the king of Moab, has sent a delegation to Balaam asking him to come and pronounce this curse. So this is Numbers 22:7-14. So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the fees for divination in their hand. And they came to Balaam and repeated Balak's words to him. And he said to them, "Spend the night here, and I will bring word back to you as Yahweh may speak to me." And the leaders of Moab stayed with Balaam. Then God came to Balaam and said, "Who are these men with you?" And Balaam said to God, "Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent word to me, 'Behold, there is a people who came out of Egypt, and they cover the surface of the land. Now come, curse them for me. Perhaps I may be able to fight against them and drive them out.'" And God said to Balaam, "Do not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed." So Balaam arose in the morning and said to Balak's leaders, "Go back to your land, for Yahweh has refused to let me go with you." And the leaders of Moab arose and went to Balak and said, "Balaam refused to come with us." Okay. The text has not given us a lot of information about Balaam at this point. I mean, what are his motives? What kind of a relationship does he have with Yahweh that he's going and asking him these questions? I am going to argue that by the time we look at the full picture of Balaam, it is clear that he is not a follower of Yahweh in the sense that he has a heart for God. He is not one who wants to submit to Yahweh and obey Yahweh and do the will of Yahweh. That's not the kind of guy that Balaam is. So when we come to this at first, we're sort of left wondering, well, where is Balaam coming from? What kind of a guy is he here? What do we see so far? The leaders of Moab and Midian bring money to Balaam to pay him to curse Israel. Now, if he were a straight-ahead kind of guy, we might assume this detail about the money is just to show that he's so devoted to Yahweh that he won't even take money to do this stuff. But that's not the kind of guy Balaam is, in fact. I think it will become clear that he would love to take their money. We don't see him having any particular objection to cursing this people. I mean, they're coming to pay him to do this curse, and he's saying, "Well, okay, let me see what Yahweh says." I think he would be happy if Yahweh were to say, "Okay, yeah, you can convince me to stop blessing these people and curse them instead." And Balaam would end up getting paid. I think, in fact, that is where he is coming from. But the task involves separating Israel from the protection of this God Yahweh. And so I think Balaam is hoping to communicate with Yahweh to see if it's going to be possible for him to pull off this curse. Now, Balaam, in the part we're going to read next, casually refers to Yahweh as my God. And that might sound as if he were a genuine follower of Yahweh, but I think it's also possible that this just reflects Balaam's approach to his task as a seer, a diviner. I mean, I'm really not sure. It's hard to be definitive about this, but I think it's quite possible to picture him as becoming a follower of the God of the people that he is dealing with, and then hoping to win that God over to his side. So in this case, it's quite possible that Balaam is taking on the stance of one who is bowing before this God that's come along, this Yahweh, so that he can convince him to do what he wants. I don't know. Again, it's difficult to be confident that we know exactly what was going on, but I think it will become clearer as we go along that Balaam is not, his purposes are more devious than it might sound at first. So he goes to pray to Yahweh, and Yahweh tells him, nope, don't go with these men. Those people that you want to curse, they are blessed. I'm looking out for them. I don't want you to even go with these guys. So Balaam says he can't go, and the men leave, and presumably they take back the fees of divination that they had brought with them. And again, the text doesn't say so, but I think as we put the whole story together, it is reasonable to think that Balaam is somewhat regretful that he was not able to earn the money that they came to pay him. Okay, so we read next then, starting in verse 15. Then Balak again sent leaders, more numerous and more distinguished than the former. And they came to Balaam and said to him, "Thus says Balak, the son of Zippor, let nothing, I beg you, hinder you from coming to me, for I will indeed honor you richly, and I will do whatever you say to me. Please come then, curse this people for me." And Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, "Though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything, either great, small or great, contrary to the command of Yahweh my God. And now, please, you also stay here tonight, and I will find out what else Yahweh will speak to me." And God came to Balaam at night and said to him, "If the men have come to call you, rise up and go with them. But only the word which I speak to you shall you do." So, this time, even more important men come to try to convince Balaam, and they are making these great promises in the name of King Balak. Essentially, they're offering Balaam a blank check. "I will honor you richly. I will do whatever you say." I mean, he's basically just saying, "I'm giving you free rein. Whatever you want from me, I will give you if you will come and curse them." So Balaam talks to Yahweh again, and this time Yahweh tells him that he can go. Now, this has got to be pretty exciting. I mean, they're offering him the world, and Yahweh is saying, "You can go." But he puts in this little qualification: "You can only say what I tell you to. My words have to dictate what's going to happen here. You're only going to do what I say." So his situation is he's been offered this blank check, and this time Yahweh has said he can go with him. Now, Yahweh warns him that he's got to do what Yahweh tells him to do, but I think that it's not outside the realm of what's reasonable to think that Balaam at this point may be thinking, "Hey, maybe this is still going to work out. I get to go, and maybe, you know, maybe I'm going to pull this off. Maybe I'll manage to get around this Yahweh guy or something, and maybe I'll be able to make the money. Maybe I'll be able to be paid off this incredible wealth that has been promised to me." Now, why would I read Balaam's motives so cynically? Why not see him as being straight ahead and genuinely wanting to do the will of Yahweh? Well, the first strong evidence that we should see Balaam as having duplicitous motives in this comes in the next part of the story. This is where we see the donkey. And I'm going to read the whole thing to you here. It's a little long. Numbers 22, starting in verse 21. "So Balaam arose in the morning and saddled his donkey and went with the leaders of Moab. But God was angry because he was going, and the angel of Yahweh took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. Now he was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. When the donkey saw the angel of Yahweh standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, the donkey turned off from the way and went into the field. But Balaam struck the donkey to turn her back into the way. Then the angel of Yahweh stood in a narrow path of the vineyards, with a wall on this side and a wall on that side. When the donkey saw the angel of Yahweh, she pressed herself to the wall and pressed Balaam's foot against the wall. So he struck her again. And the angel of Yahweh went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn to the right hand or the left. When the donkey saw the angel of Yahweh, she lay down under Balaam. So Balaam was angry and struck the donkey with his stick. And Yahweh opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?" Then Balaam said to the donkey, "Because you have made a mockery of me, if there had been a sword in my hand, I would have killed you by now." And the donkey said to Balaam, "Am I not your donkey on which you have ridden all your life to this day? Have I ever been accustomed to do so to you?" And he said, "No." Then Yahweh opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel of Yahweh standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand. And he bowed all the way to the ground. And the angel of Yahweh said to him, "Why have you struck your donkey these three times? Behold, I have come out as an adversary, because your way was contrary to me. But the donkey saw me and turned aside from me these three times. If she had not turned aside from me, I would surely have killed you just now and let her live." And Balaam said to the angel of Yahweh, "I have sinned, for I did not know that you were standing in the way against me. Now then, if it is displeasing to you, I will turn back." But the angel of Yahweh said to Balaam, "Go with the men, but you shall speak only the word which I shall tell you." So Balaam went along with the leaders of Balak. Okay, now you may have noticed right off the bat that this little episode starts with something kind of strange. God told Balaam that he could go, but then it says that God was angry with Balaam for going. Now, you know, there are a variety of approaches to this fact. Some critics take this as evidence that several stories have been kind of stitched together here, and they didn't notice that the stories didn't match up. But I could go on for some time about what a lame way of approaching any text that is. I think it makes much more sense to assume that the writer knows what he wrote. I mean, it's within two verses. In verse 20, God says to go, and in verse 22, God is angry with him for going. I just find it very difficult to believe that the author of this did not notice that that was the case. So I'm assuming that the writer intends us to see that discrepancy, and that in fact intends us to read the whole story to try to put it together, to say why is it that this is happening this way. Is it right to conclude that God has really changed his mind about this? He told Balaam to go, but then he decided that he didn't want him to go, and he's mad at him for going? Well, I don't think that's the best way to read what it means, what is behind the anger that God has in this situation. Because look how the story ends. When Balaam finally sees the angel, he says, "Okay, sorry, I'll go back if you want me to." Now, if God had changed his mind and was angry with him for going, then you would expect him to say, "Yeah, that's right, you go back. I don't want you going with these guys." But that's not what he says. He basically repeats to him again what he had said before. "You go with them, but you're only going to say what I give you to say." So I think that implies that God did this whole episode with the donkey to reinforce one idea with Balaam. When you go, you can only say what I tell you to say. And that implies, I think, that Balaam needed that reinforcement. Balaam was going for his own reasons. yes, God had said that he could go, but he was not really going in obedience to God. He was going with his own ulterior motives. And it's not hard to figure out what those reasons would be. Balaam has been offered a blank check, vast wealth, if he would curse Israel. If he can please Balak with what he does when he goes there, he's going to be in the money. So when Yahweh told him that he could go, presumably he needs to be corrected at this point because he was harboring a hope that he could get around Yahweh some way, curse Israel, and make himself, you know, a boatload of cash. So I think the implication when you look at the whole story is that God is not angry with Balaam merely because Balaam is going with the men. God is angry with Balaam for the reasons that Balaam is going, how quick he was to go when God said, okay. He has these ulterior motives. So God takes Balaam through this donkey and angel psychodrama precisely because Balaam needs to be reminded. When he gets there, he is not going to curse Israel. He is not going to get rich. He is only going to say what God gives him to say. Now, another thing that critics of the Bible point out is the strangeness of this story. I mean, can we really credit this story? It sounds more like Aesop's fables or something. You know, it has a talking donkey in it. I mean, stories with talking donkeys are not typically what we think of as historical accounts of what happened in the past. But again, I think if we think about it, that this story makes a lot of sense in this way. It is like an enacted parable for Balaam's sake. Balaam fancies himself as a seer. He alone can see into the mysteries of the divine. He alone can invoke the powers of the gods to bless or to curse. He is a unique individual. He can see into the divine world and control what is going on there. That's how he sees himself. But as he is riding along, presumably nursing visions of the great wealth he might be able to get from Balak, all of a sudden he can't see anything. It is his donkey that sees the angel. It is his donkey who is in control of Balaam's progress and even his bodily health. He's bumping up against the wall and crushing his foot. And it is his donkey who ultimately is the mouthpiece of the divine. The donkey is the one who is the seer in this situation, and Balaam is just totally out of it. Well, I think that's intended to hit home to Balaam. Here he is thinking of himself as having these great mystical powers, but when it comes to this god Yahweh, Yahweh can grant mystical powers to a donkey, even as he withholds those powers from Balaam. So the very strangeness of the story, I think, is intended to bring home to Balaam his true situation. Well, I think that the anger of Yahweh and his response to Balaam in this situation really raises a suspicion that Balaam's motives are a lot more suspect than it might have looked at first. God has to warn him, "You have no hope of thwarting me. You only have one choice. You must say what I tell you to say." So in the story that follows, when Balaam pronounces blessings and not curses, it's not necessarily because he wants to. It's not because he is a devout follower of Yahweh that he is blessing Israel. I think the text seems to strongly imply that if God wasn't riding herd on him here, that he would curse Israel if he could get away with it. If he could curse Israel and make this massive amount of money up from Balak the king, he would do it. But God has pressed down and made it clear to him that that's not what's going to happen, that Yahweh is in control, and he has no choice but to bless rather than curse. All right, now, to my mind, there is one more piece of evidence that absolutely clinches this. If you still have doubts as to whether Balaam is that kind of guy or not, I think this one more little piece of evidence makes it clear that he is indeed that kind of guy. And this is that little phrase that I said that shows up later in Numbers. But in order to understand this little phrase, I have to tell you just a little bit more. So immediately after this story of Balaam, starting in Numbers 25, verse 1, it says, "While Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab, for they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and Yahweh was angry against Israel." Okay, so this is right after the story of Balaam, the very next thing that we hear about. And this story, as we read the whole thing, which I'm not going to do, it involves the Moabites, and later we see it also involves the Midianites. That is, these are the Moabites and the Midianites, the very folks who had just sent the envoy to Balaam to ask him to come curse Israel. And what did the Moabites, and the Midianites are also involved in this, what did they do? Well, I think the key sentence here is verse 2. "They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods." At the instigation of the Moabites and the Midianites, the people of Israel have turned away from Yahweh. So Yahweh had previously told Balaam to pronounce a blessing on Israel. But now Israel has committed idolatry, sacrificing to the gods of the Moabites and the Midianites, to Baal of Peor. And because of this idolatry, Yahweh himself brings a curse upon Israel. In verse 9, it said there was a plague that killed 24,000 Israelites. And this story recounts what it is ultimately that they do and how God's judgment upon them is lifted and so on. I won't go into all of that. But a question that we might ask at this point is, did the Moabites and the Midianites actually do this deliberately? Was their purpose to trip up Israel and to separate Israel from the care of their God, Yahweh? Well, later in verse 17 in Numbers 25, it says, God is speaking to Moses here, I think, "Be hostile to the Midianites and strike them, for they have been hostile to you with their tricks, with which they have deceived you in the affair of Peor." So God is referring back to that very thing that happened, where the people invited the Israelites to come and attend their sacrifices, and they ended up indulging in idolatry and immorality, I would say, and God's judgment comes upon them. The Midianites tricked and deceived Israel by inviting the people to attend these sacrifices, and it had the intended result. The people abandoned Yahweh, and so Yahweh, for a time, abandoned them. So, what does this have to do with Balaam? Why am I bringing this up? Well, now this is where we get this one little phrase, and this is found in Numbers chapter 31, verse 15. In Numbers 31, Israel is now following God's instructions. He had just told Moses, "I want you to attack. I want you to go at the Midianites because of the way they tricked you." So they're following God's instructions. They now have been at war with them and wiping them out. But in verse 15, Moses said to the Israelites, "Have you spared all the women? Behold, these caused the sons of Israel, through the counsel of Balaam, to trespass against Yahweh in the matter of Peor. So the plague was among the congregation of the Lord," congregation of Yahweh. Moses at this spot is urging Israel, at God's instruction, to be ruthless to the Midianites. They had deliberately enticed Israel to trespass against God. They did this deliberately, and in response to Israel's idolatry, God brought a plague upon them. This is what the Midianites set out to do, to cause Israel to stumble, to turn against Yahweh so that Yahweh would turn against them. But notice that there is this one extra little piece of information that Moses gives us in there. The Midianites did not come up with this strategy on their own. They did it on the advice of Balaam. So this, I think, then finally gives us the full story of what's going on. Balaam wanted to earn riches from the Moabites and Midianites by cursing Israel, but Yahweh was unwilling to curse Israel, would not let him curse Israel, and so Balaam could only pronounce a blessing instead of a curse. But afterwards, Balaam went to them with a new strategy. If the people turn away from Yahweh, he will no longer protect them. Why is Yahweh protecting them? Because he has decided that he is going to bless them. But entice the Israelites to follow your gods. Entice them to turn away from Yahweh and make sacrifices to your gods. Yahweh himself then will curse them. If they turn away from him, he will turn from them. So you convince them to turn away from him and they will lose his protection. That was Balaam's advice, I think, when you look at the whole thing. I couldn't come and pronounce a curse because God wouldn't let me, but if they turn away from him, God himself will curse him. I think that's what Balaam is telling them. And presumably, it doesn't say so, because it's not Moses' point at that spot, but presumably Balaam ended up being paid for his successful advice. In the end, he found a way to curse Israel. He convinced the Midianites to follow his advice, and it worked. 24,000 people were killed. I think we have a hint of what Yahweh's final judgment on Balaam was, because we're told that Balaam was killed in this war that Israel waged against the Midianites. In attacking the Midianites, Balaam was one of the ones who died. Okay. So when you look at the whole story, I think it's pretty clear the kind of guy Balaam was and what his motives were in this situation. So let me take us back to the New Testament. We're heading for 2 Peter, but I'm going to take a little detour through a couple of things, and then we'll arrive at 2 Peter. Start with the book of Revelation. In the book of Revelation, Jesus has a series of messages to seven churches in Asia Minor. You may be familiar with those letters to the seven churches in Revelation. In Revelation 2:14, he says this to the church in Pergamum. But I have a few things against you, because you have there some who hold the teaching of Balaam, who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit acts of immorality. Okay, notice that Jesus here in Revelation is interpreting numbers along the lines of what we have suggested. Balak isn't mentioned in that little phrase at the end, but Balak is a part of this story, right? He called in Balaam. He wanted him to curse them. He couldn't curse them. He could only bless them. But Balaam, we're told, is the one who goes and gives the advice, hey, the way to get them is to cause them to commit idolatry and turn away from Yahweh. So that's how Jesus puts it here. He kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel. That's what Balaam did. And they followed his advice. Israel's enemies invited them to their sacrifices, and this led Israel to commit idolatry and acts of immorality. And Jesus is suggesting that there are some in Pergamum who are following this same sort of path, putting a stumbling block before the people of God like Balaam did. Okay, now I want to quickly take you to the book of Jude. Remember, the book of Jude is quite parallel to this chapter 2 in Peter, and what we're going to look at here is the parallel in Jude to the part that we're looking at in 2 Peter. This is the Jude 11 in the one chapter book of Jude. This is verse 11. Jude says, "Woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain, and for pay they have rushed headlong into the error of Balaam and perished in the rebellion of Korah." So Jude has in mind You know, because we don't exactly know the circumstances and all this stuff, we don't know if Jude is writing into exactly the same situation or a similar sort of situation. I mean, there are different ways of putting that together. But the situation is similar to the, at least, to the false teachers that Peter is writing against in 2 Peter. And Jude compares them to three Old Testament examples, Cain, Balaam, and those who rebelled against God at Korah. And each of these examples, I think, makes perfect sense as analogies to the situation that Jude is writing to. Cain, the first example, well, he ended up killing his brother. And these false teachers are, in essence, leading their brothers, their so-called brothers, other believers, to their doom. The third example, the rebellion of Korah, this was the time when Korah and others rose up to challenge the leadership of Moses and Aaron. They basically said, are they in charge? They wanted to be in charge. They wanted to have the power of leadership for themselves, just as the false teachers are setting themselves up as the true teachers instead of the apostles. They're grabbing power for themselves. And then we have this example of Balaam. Notice what Jude says, for pay, they have rushed headlong into the error of Balaam. He brings out this idea that the motivation here is a financial one. They're doing it for pay. And that comes right out of the story of Balaam as we're understanding what Balaam's motives were. What did Balaam do? He caused the people of God to turn away from him, and he did it for the sake of his own financial gain. He caused the people of God to stumble, to turn away from God. And why did he do it? Because he was going to profit for it. It was for pay. He wanted the pay that he was going to get. Just as the false teachers are leading people astray and profiting off of them at the same time. Okay? Now, finally, let's turn back to our passage in 2 Peter. I know this is 2 Peter we're talking about, so we're finally back in 2 Peter. In verse 15, he says, forsaking the right way, they have gone astray, having followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. But he received a rebuke for his own transgression, for a dumb donkey, speaking with a voice of a man, restrained the madness of the prophet. Okay, well, I think as we look at that now, Peter is basically affirming the way we were just reading the story of Balaam in the comments that he makes here. He's saying that he was motivated by greed, by a desire for wealth. He says he loved the wages of unrighteousness. And that's what we were very strongly concluding, what seemed to be strongly implied in the story of Balaam, that the problem here is that he really wanted to get the money that was being promised him if he could trip Israel up. Peter sees the episode of the donkey as a rebuke against Balaam for his love of the wages of unrighteousness. Notice how he said, he loved the wages of unrighteousness, but he received a rebuke for his own transgression. The episode of the donkey, Peter is reading as a rebuke that God is directing against Balaam for the kind of motives that he has, which is this love of the wages of unrighteousness. Peter sees the donkey restraining the madness of the prophet. So this is very strong language. Balaam wasn't just innocently going along saying, okay, he told me to go, so I'll go. And now there's an angel there saying, no, I don't want you to go. He's like, make up your mind. I don't even get where you're coming from. No, Balaam had definitely, as Peter is seeing it, and it seems to me to be a very legitimate way to read the story, Peter is seeing Balaam as essentially mad. That is, he was mad to think that he could somehow prevail over Yahweh. He was mad to think that he could earn King Balak's money by pronouncing a curse on Israel when God had said that's not going to happen. And it took this bizarre episode of the donkey to wake Balaam up, to convince him that he had no hope of prevailing and that he was going to have to do what Yahweh told him to. How then is Peter seeing the false teachers as being like Balaam? Why does he invoke this story? I think there are these two things, and we've seen both of these elements. up to this point as we've been going through Peter. We will see more again. We see it in this context that we're looking at here. There are these two things. They are covetous, like Balaam, seeking the personal gratification of wealth and sensual indulgence. That's one thing that's true about these false teachers. And they don't care if they lure the people of God to their destruction to get what they want. To trip up other believers is not a concern of theirs as long as they get out of the situation what they want. And those two things are like Balaam. He wanted to get paid, and he didn't care whether he brought Israel down, the people of God, in the process. And so in the passage we were looking at here today, just before the Balaam part, we see both of these elements. They're motivated by covetousness. Peter says that they have hearts trained in greed, and maybe a better translation would be hearts trained in covetousness. That is, they want things that they cannot obtain righteously. They want what they want, and it doesn't really matter that God does not want them to live the way they want to live. They want to go that way anyway. He says that they have eyes full of adultery. Literally, it's a little bit tough to put the thing together. It says they have eyes full of an adulteress. And I think the idea is that basically they are on the lookout among the believers for women that they can convince to commit adultery with them. All this fits what Peter has been saying all along about their greed and sensuality. I mean, this is the picture of the false teachers that he's been painting from the beginning. And then that other part of it is true as well. They don't really care if they lead believers astray in order to get what they want. That is, they're not concerned about the spiritual health of the people that they're involved with. What they're concerned about is that they can milk the situation and get out of it what they want. Peter says that they entice unstable souls. He says that they revel in their deceptions. And this fits what he's been saying all along. Earlier, he said that they exploit you with false words. Peter is very concerned that the false teachers in this situation are going to convince people to abandon the truths of the gospel and the implications of that gospel for the way they live, and instead end up emulating and following the false teachers instead. And we're going to see Peter is going to go on and say similar things that we'll see next week. Okay, so what does this add up to then? Where are we here? I think that this example of Balaam helps us to see what Peter is most concerned about in this letter, because it's so fitting with what we have seen from beginning to end is his concern. Balaam was not an unbeliever in the sense that he did not believe in Yahweh. He obviously did believe in Yahweh up to a point. I mean, he was having interaction with Yahweh, and he knew that he had to keep Yahweh happy or he was going to be in trouble. But he didn't submit to Yahweh. He didn't see any need to change his perspective on life, to truly, actually humble himself before Yahweh, to make Yahweh's will his purpose and desire. He wanted what he wanted, and if he could find a way to get around Yahweh to do that, then that's what he would do. And he didn't care what happened to Yahweh's people. The fact that Yahweh wanted to bless the people of Israel was not a concern to him. Well, that's the kind of people that the false teachers are. They present themselves among the Christians as believers, and in fact, that may be true in the sense that they actually believe in God. They may not be talking out of both sides of their mouth. I mean, they may actually, in fact, when they say, hey, you know, we believe in Jesus, they may actually mean that, but they have changed the picture of the God and Jesus that they believe in so that they can have what they want. They're not willing to submit to God and to his Messiah. They're not willing to restrain themselves from pursuing what they want. They have convinced themselves that they don't need to restrain themselves from pursuing what they want. In fact, they find a way to make covetousness and sensuality seem like a valid thing for a follower of God to pursue. And that's the dangerous part, is that people will become convinced that they have something there, that, yeah, this is a legitimate way that you might go. And since they are not personally, ultimately, concerned about submitting to the will of God, they're not concerned about the fact that they are enticing others to live the same way they are. Because, hey, the way they're living makes sense to them. And implied in all of this, I think, like Balaam's situation, they have learned that a person can profit by causing other people to stumble. And here's what I mean. And in Balaam's situation, it was a specific thing. The king's saying, hey, come and curse these people. And Balaam's saying, hey, if I could curse these people, I'd get rich. It's not like that. But I think what Peter is implying when he talks about exploiting them with false words and a number of things that he says here is that they have learned that they can profit by teaching an attractive but false message, that the kinds of false teaching that they're doing can be attractive to people. It can suck people in. They can think, oh, yeah, okay, that's the way to go. Many people like hearing that the path of following God can involve sensuality and self-indulgence and covetousness. And you can end up gaining position. You can gain power. You can gain wealth by telling people what they want to hear. And I think that's what Peter is concerned about. There are those who will present themselves as believers, but in fact, what they have learned is they can profit off of you by taking you the wrong direction, the direction that they're going. They're going to find those people who will like this direction and they will go with them. That's Peter's warning. Think about Balaam. I mean, it's just like that. In our own time, it's easy to see the obvious examples of what Peter is talking about. Last time I mentioned this, I said I wasn't going to name names. I changed my mind. I'm going to name names. Let's talk about the obvious examples first. I mean, this is the really obvious examples. I have my doubts that there are many people in this room who will disagree with me about the examples that I'm about to talk about. But the fact is, just because it's obvious doesn't mean that we shouldn't point it out. I mean, it's obvious, so let's make sure we point it out. It's been many years, actually, as I think about it, since I watched any so-called Christian television, so things might have changed. I don't want to say what's happening now because I don't know what's happening now. I have paid no attention to it whatsoever. But at an earlier point in my life, I used to sometimes watch things like the Trinity Broadcasting Network and that stuff, you know, Paul and Jan and Benny Hinn and all of those folks. I would turn them on to see what was going on. Well, back then, when I watched that stuff, those folks, to me, are an obvious and terrible example of men getting rich by leading people astray. They followed in the dubious footsteps of Oral Roberts in teaching something like his seed faith. I'm sure you're probably familiar with this. God wants you to be rich and healthy. He wants you to be fully satisfied in this life now. But you have to demonstrate your faith in order for that to happen. So you have to plant your seed. You have to cast your bread upon the waters and all of that different various sorts of language that gets used. And how do you do that? Funny thing. You send the evangelist money. That's how you prove to God your faith. In fact, how can you expect God to make you fabulously wealthy and healthy if you don't demonstrate the depths of your faith by giving to me, the evangelist, all your money? I mean, you give me a couple of bucks, God's going to look at that and say, oh, what kind of faith does that take? Sell your house and give me the proceeds. That will show God that you really mean business. And I am not setting up a straw man. That is absolutely 100% true. I'm not exaggerating. That was the message. That was what was there. And so what you see is the disgusting picture of people who are very poor, sending their money to millionaire evangelists so they can buy another mansion and another Ferrari and another yacht and that stuff. You know, we all have a visceral reaction to that stuff, right? You know, like we bring language out, you know, there isn't a spot in hell hot enough and, you know, all of that kind of thing. But this is a reality, right? Even worse than taking their money, though, I would say, is that they were teaching them a form of Christianity which was, in fact, a perversion of what the heart of the gospel really is about. I've told this story many times, but it captures exactly what I mean. You know, all of this ripping off poor people and buying mansions and stuff, that's disgusting, but in some ways, this was the thing that really opened my eyes to the whole deal. I once heard Benny Hinn say to the people he was talking to, "One day, when people get to heaven, they will say, 'Where is the blessing that God promised me?' And God will tell them, 'You missed it. It was back there. The blessing that I have for you, if you don't get in on it now," and how do you do that? You send me money. "If you don't get in on it now, you're going to miss it. Because what God has for you is this great life now. And you're going to miss it unless you step up and do what's required." Well, this is the essence of what I mean by kind of an anti-gospel. They are not teaching us to wait patiently through the trials of this life for the promises of the kingdom. They are urging us to expect health and wealth, to demand that God keep his promises to give us those things now, because, after all, God shares our belief that the most important thing is to be satisfied in this life now. God believes that just as much as you do, but he isn't going to help you to get to that spot unless you show the depths of your faith by sending me money. Not me, them. I'm speaking for them. Okay. And so covetousness becomes a virtue. It has become, there is a God-sanctioned covetousness. God wants you to want that stuff, but you have to demonstrate that you have enough faith in order to get it. Okay. And, of course, as we have seen over time, ultimately the truth starts to come out, and there's a lot of old-fashioned sensuality going on behind the scenes in these ministries as well. A lot of affairs and divorces and more affairs and drug overdoses and all kinds of stuff. I mean, a serious commitment to self-indulgence is characteristic of a lot of the people in that world. Okay, like I say, easy target. I mean, we can all go home feeling virtuous because we're not like that. But, I mean, I got to say it, just in case you have any doubts about it, I would say that what Peter is describing here fits them to a T. That's like the most obvious and blatant example of it. And we know, I mean, that there are a lot of people who buy it, and it's a very sad thing. But that obvious problem is not the only way that the things that Peter is concerned about here can manifest themselves. I think there are subtler versions of what he's getting at. What would that look like? Here, I don't have anything in particular that I want to point to. What I want to say is, let's think to ourselves, what would the litmus test be for us? What would I be looking for in something that claimed to be Christian, but was in fact false teaching that was leading me in the wrong direction? Well, what has Peter been concerned about? What has he been trying to convince them is that they should believe and do? He says that the apostolic gospel is all about arriving at life and godliness. We saw that right from the beginning. We have two problems. One, we are ungodly. We are evil. We are sinners. And two, we deserve death. So we are sinners, and we're going to pay for it with our lives, eternally. We lose. The gospel shows how to escape the condemnation, the death that we deserve through faith in the sacrifice of Christ on the cross. God sent his Son so that we might find mercy and forgiveness. That's what the gospel is largely about. And the gospel also promises us that God's power is being exerted toward us to change us from ungodliness to godliness. So the gospel is about how we can find mercy and so find life, and how we can, through the intervention of God in our lives, ultimately arrive at righteousness, godliness, that we can be freed from our own moral corruption. So life and godliness, that's what the gospel is about. And so our goal, as Peter sees it, must be to believe in and desire the life and godliness that God has promised. And if we in fact believe and desire what God has promised, then we will live in a way that reflects the fact that we believe that and we want that. So how can you tell teaching that truly reflects the apostolic gospel? It speaks of our need for mercy and rescue from death. It speaks of our need to be rescued from our own sinful hearts. It points to the gospel of Jesus Christ as the means by which we will find life and godliness. And it urges us to believe so sincerely that our belief shows itself in how we live. That's the heart of what the gospel is about, what true teaching is about. And the farther that a teacher moves from that central core, the more likely it is that he is a false teacher. So the televangelist's overt commitment to materialism and sensuality and all of that kind of stuff, I mean, already makes it really obvious where they're coming from. But I would say when we're listening to other people, if we were to follow Peter's advice here and try to think what would it look like for someone who is taking me down the wrong path, that's what we would be looking for. Is it about finding life and godliness through the work of Christ and the power of God's Spirit working in us? And is it leading us to embrace that message deeply and fully so that our lives reflect it? That's what gospel teaching looks like. And if it's not like that, the farther away it gets, the less like the teaching of the New Testament it is, and the more potential it has to lead us astray. So I'm done pounding on the pulpit here, so we have a few minutes for any questions or comments you might have.
Yeah, this kind of going back to the story of Balaam and the donkey, that the King James very tastefully in 2 Peter says the dumb ass spoke to the prophet.
Right, that's right.
The story, out of all the stories in the Bible, it's the one that when I read it, it's the most inviting to make me go, what's up with this story? There's something about it. I really, really like that kind of spin you put on it. I think it's probably the intention of the story is that the donkey sees the angel and the donkey becomes God's mouthpiece. And so, you know, Balaam finds the donkey as God's mouthpiece when he's blind. And so that's an interesting thing that could be going on there. But still my question, reading the story, despite as much as it says, it's very strange that you have a talking donkey. It's very strange that Balaam hears the donkey and doesn't say, I mean, if I had a dog or a cat and one day it just sat on the couch and started talking with me, I'd be calling the cops. I mean, or I'd try to get a TV station. There's something weird there. He doesn't react to the donkey as if it's strange. The donkey talks. The donkey sees an angel. Certainly, you know, some have argued that Job is a fiction, and yet it's some kind of inspired fiction. And we know that it's not strange for a society to create fictions to build up their society. And I'm not advocating this view because it wouldn't be my disposition to lean that direction. But I really understand that lens. So can you speak to that, some of those issues a little bit?
Well, all I can say, I think, is this. I understand what you're saying. I mean, I understand the place where I could be sitting and how I would look at that story where it would seem that way. Like, okay, you know, this is a fable that was made up to make some point or something like that. I mean, it is strange. But this is in the same account that is talking about Moses finding a burning bush that talks to him. Moses raises his staff and the Red Sea parts. If I cross over the line into accepting God was in the business of, at this time, in his interaction with Israel and the people around them, this was a time when he was going to be overt and make himself known in a variety of ways that were miraculous so that you really he gets your attention. You know, the fact that Israel would not trust God as they were going along is just highlighted by time after time where God has intervened on their behalf in obviously miraculous ways so that there's something that you have to interact with. If once you get across that line, then the fact that parts of the story, I mean, the fact that like Balaam doesn't say, whoa, how come you're talking, or something like that. If this is a historical account, if let's just say for the sake of argument that this really happened, that sort of thing fits the way the Old Testament stories are told all the time. I mean, a lot of times they're told very spare and a lot of pieces are left out. I mean, I could see the author very easily choosing to concentrate on ultimately the point where Balaam answers the question that he was asked by the donkey. I mean, it may have been several minutes before he did it. I mean, I'm just making that up, but I mean, it could have been any number of things that he would have done. The fact that we want the story to recount it that way, I think, reflects our culture and mindset about how this sort of thing ought to be done. But when you go back and look at the way the stories in the Old Testament are told, I find it easy to believe that in the situation, it could have gone any number of ways. What we're getting is kind of the basic outline of what it is that happened. Now, I was listening to David's teaching on Numbers from a number of years ago in this section, just to kind of see where David was coming from. And unfortunately, the part that I most wanted to hear was the part was missing on the tape, so that didn't work too well. But I did notice that the next week after it, David was kicking around the idea, the possibility that the donkey part of the story could have been like a vision or a dream or something that Balaam had before his setting out, you know, to kind of raise these issues. I'm not ready to go to that spot yet, but I think it raises the legitimate question, rather than seeing the story as potentially bogus because it has unusual elements, we could take an unskeptical approach to that and say, what did the author expect us to do with the unusual elements of the story? How did he expect us to take this? The possibility that the author expected us to put the weirdness of the story together and say, this was a visionary thing that happened here. I mean, that's possible. I guess what I would say is, the fact that God would do something miraculous is not at all outside the realm of possibility. I think the Bible has earned the right for us to read it sympathetically at this spot and ask, what did the author want us to do with the unusual nature of the story? And like I'm saying, what makes sense to me is that the unusualness of it, the strangeness of a talking donkey, like I said, I'm thinking of it as like an enacted parable, that God is putting Balaam into a situation in a very weird and striking way, is bringing home to him how far off he is and how he's thinking about this. And that makes sense to me.
Yeah, so it seems like the bottom line of the situation is that your hermeneutical presuppositions determine how you view the text. So if I accept that Samson lifted up a gate that was probably like 10,000 times his weight and that he killed 10,000 men with a jawbone, and if I accept that Moses parted the Red Sea with a stick and that a talking snake caused the first sin, if I accept these and I have a presupposition that comes to the Bible, then it's easy to sympathize with taking Balaam and the donkey very literally. And I sympathize with that view. I mean, the theophanies and things like that in the Old Testament with the burning bush don't seem strange to me because, okay, sure, so if I presume that God exists, which I think that's a very easy presumption to make, then I can say that God is supernatural, above our category's existence, doesn't have to follow the rules of natural law, and therefore can do a burning bush thing. I guess the situation with the donkey is that it's so comic bookish. It's like something you would read in some story where, you know, there was three-headed people and...
Not necessarily. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is there's another way to understand the unusual nature of what's been said there.
It's a little bit of a curiosity. I've been thinking about the false teachers, and did Balaam, in fact, curse Israel?
You mean by his ultimate convincing them to use this trick on Israel?
He was hired to place a curse, but he instead blessed Israel for it. So I was thinking about how false teachers sometimes will act like they're following God. I mean, he acted like he was following God.
Right.
God stopped him from doing a certain thing, sent the donkey, he had an aha moment, acted like he was following God, and yet because he didn't curse Israel doesn't mean he didn't manipulate his way around it to in fact cause Israel's demise, so to speak.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right, and that's what I'm understanding happened, is that after he was thwarted from pronouncing this curse on them, convinced them to go another way to bring them down. Yeah,
kind of disconcerting when you're thinking about false teachers, because they look like they are, in fact, following God's way, but there's this underlying manipulation that you can't see so much.
Right.
If it wasn't for those extra little passages, in fact, you wouldn't necessarily know that Balaam had even done that.
Right.
Jan was making a great point back to the discussion on the talking donkey. She's spent 25 years in the Middle Eastern culture living in Pakistan, and I'd like to pass the microphone to her.
Oh, sneaky.
It was along with the comment you made about the culture. Mm-hmm. You know, we in the West are so scientific, but many other cultures really do expect supernatural happenings. And I think with Balaam already having communicated with God in one way, and God had talked to him and told him what he wanted them to do, I don't think Balaam necessarily would have thought God speaking to him again and the donkey was unusual. I mean, God was communicating with people in those days. And our culture is so absolutely, it doesn't happen kind of thing that...
No, I do think that's right. At least potentially, we do have to recognize that the way a story feels to us can be quite different than it would have felt to the author. He wouldn't have felt the need to put in the things that would convince us that it was a certain kind of story, because they wouldn't have felt the need for those things. So, yeah, that's good. Okay, we'll let go with that, and thank you all. We'll pick it up next week.